Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Bible, chapter 10, verse 12. And now, O Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you? But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to observe the Lord's commands and decrees that I am giving you today for your own good. To the Lord your God belong the heavens, even the highest heavens, the earth and everything in it. Yet the Lord set his affection on your forefathers and loved them, and he chose you, their descendants, above all the nations as it is today. Circumcise your hearts, therefore, and do not be stiff-necked any longer. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow, and loves the alien, giving him food and clothing. And you are to love those who are aliens, for you yourselves were aliens in Egypt. Fear the Lord your God and serve him. Hold fast to him and take your oaths in his name. He is your praise. He is your God, who performed for you those great and awesome wonders you saw with your own eyes. Your forefathers who went down into Egypt were 70 in all, and now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars in the sky. Love the Lord your God and keep his requirements, his decrees, his laws, and his commands always. Remember today that your children were not the ones who saw and experienced the discipline of the Lord your God, his majesty, his mighty hand, his outstretched arm, the signs he performed and the things he did in the heart of Egypt, both to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to his whole country. What he did to the Egyptian army, to its horses and chariots, how he overwhelmed them with the waters of the Red Sea as they were pursuing you, and how the Lord brought lasting ruin on them. It was not your children who saw what he did for you in the desert until you arrived at this place, and what he did to Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab the Reubenite, when the earth opened its mouth right in the middle of all Israel and swallowed them up with their households, their tents, and every living thing that belonged to them. But it was your own eyes that saw all these great things the Lord has done. Observe, therefore, all the commands I'm giving you today, so that you may have the strength to go in and take over the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess, and so that you may live long in the land that the Lord swore to your forefathers to give to them and to their descendants, to give to them and their descendants a land flowing with milk and honey. The land you are entering to take over is not like the land of Egypt from which you've come, where you planted your seed and irrigated it by foot as in a vegetable garden. But the land you are crossing the Jordan to take possession of is a land of mountains and valleys that drinks rain from heaven. It's a land the Lord your God cares for. The eyes of the Lord your God are continually on it from the beginning of the year to its end. So if you faithfully obey the commands I'm giving you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will send on your land in its season both autumn and spring rains, so that you may gather in your grain, new wine and oil. I will provide grass in the fields for your cattle, and you will eat and be satisfied. Be careful, or you will be enticed to turn away and worship other gods and bow down to them. And then the Lord's anger will burn against you, and he will shut the heavens so that it will not rain, and the ground will yield no produce, and you will soon perish from the good land the Lord is giving you. Fix these words of mine in your hearts and minds. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Teach them to your children, talking about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates, so that your days and the days of your children may be many in the land that the Lord swore to give your forefathers, as many as the days that the heavens are above the earth. If you carefully observe all these commands I'm giving you to follow, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, and to hold fast to him, then the Lord will drive out all these nations before you, and you will dispossess nations larger and stronger than you. Every place where you set your foot will be yours, from the desert to Lebanon, and from the Euphrates River to the Western Sea. No man will be able to stand against you. The Lord your God, as he has promised you, will put the terror and fear of you on the whole land wherever you go. Choices. We all make them every day. Usually they're rather trivial, aren't they? Determined more by habit or whim than conscious deliberation, maybe. What newspaper shall I read this morning? What meal shall I select from the lunch menu? What program shall I watch on the TV? Our lives are full of insignificant decisions like that. So much so that I guess most of us tend to take the ability to make such decisions rather for granted. Hey, when you think about it carefully, this human faculty of self-determination is really a rather daunting responsibility. No matter how clever our scientists are in unravelling the molecular nuts and bolts of life, we can none of us escape the psychological reality that we're not mere machines, programmed like robots to act predictably according to our brain chemistry. No, we choose. We know we do. And no scientist is going to persuade us otherwise. No matter how successful our biologists are in tracing the evolutionary origins of Homo sapiens, we can none of us deny the moral truth that we are not mere apes whose behavior can be excused by appeal to behavioral conditioning or animal instinct. No, we choose. And every now and again, situations develop in our lives which bring the seriousness of that power of choice home to us in an unmistakable way. Some of us have children at secondary school, and around now, perhaps we are discovering that they themselves are finding the power of choice to be an ominous one, as they have to be confronted with GCSE alternatives, choice that may profoundly influence their future careers. Some amongst us have fallen in love and we're going out. Shall we get married? We're asking. A choice that will have far-reaching consequences for our happiness. Some of us are doing the milk round of interviews. Shall I apply for this job? Shall I move to another country? Shall we plan to have a baby? Choices like these are far from trivial or insignificant. But there's no opting out of them, is there? For often to shelve such decisions is to decide by default. We're not in the position of customers in a bookshop who can idle their time away browsing amongst the volumes on display and then finally walk out the door not having purchased anything. No, we are human beings, and to be a human being is to choose. And to choose, whether we like it or not, is to take responsibility for our own lives. What's more, if that is true for us as individuals, I suggest to you it's also true for us in an even more momentous way as societies. When you put a group of human beings together, you'll find they don't behave as a mere collection of atoms, each doing their own thing without regard to the others. Within a very short space of time, they demonstrate a collective social psychology, a corporate consciousness. The philosopher Rousseau called it the general will. Hegel called it Geist or spirit. These days, we tend to talk in rather more prosaic terms about public opinion. But it all comes down to the same thing. Nations make choices too, just as individuals do. And just as in the case of individuals, there are critical moments in the history of any nation or people when the awesome responsibility, which inevitably accompanies that power of collective self-determination, becomes especially obvious. Now, it was at just such a watershed in her national life that Israel was standing, as Moses addresses her in this valedictory sermon that we call the Book of Deuteronomy. 40 years earlier, at Mount Sinai, the people of Israel had collectively taken an epoch-making decision. They had agreed together that they were going to bind themselves in solemn covenant to Jehovah, the Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, their forefathers, the God who had delivered them, they were persuaded, from slavery in Egypt. But that was 40 years before. Now the generation that had made that crucial step had passed on. Moses himself only had a matter of weeks or perhaps months to live. It was the children of those that Moses had led out of Egypt that now stood before him on the east bank of Jordan, poised to begin the conquest of the Promised Land. And as they prepared themselves to embark on that daring enterprise, the aged Moses is putting before them once again the choice they had to make. "This River Jordan on which you are standing," he's saying, "represents the threshold of your national destiny. Things could go either way from here. On the one hand, you could discover on the other side of this river prosperity and peace. On the other hand, you could inherit poverty and defeat. Prophet though I am, I can't guarantee the future for you. Your destiny," he says, "lies in your own hands. All that I can do is spell out for you the crucial choice upon which that destiny hinges. The decision that you must make if you want to tread the path of prosperity that God is holding out to you at this critical moment in your national history. The fact that your parents faced the same choice 40 years ago doesn't make the issue any easier or less momentous for you. For every new generation has the power either to reaffirm the faith of its forefathers or to abandon that faith. So," he says, "the choice is yours today. See, I am setting before you a blessing and a curse. A blessing if you obey the command of the Lord your God. A curse if you disobey." Now, what I want us to do this morning, as we look at this long passage, is to distill out from it four principles, four incentives, which Moses is offering to Israel to encourage them to choose the former of those two stark alternatives, the path of obedience and blessing, rather than the path of disobedience and cursing. I want us to focus in on those four incentives that Moses offers to them, because it's my conviction we too this morning, all of us, like Israel, stand on a brink of decision. There's a choice before us, a choice before us as individuals, a choice before us too as a nation. We can either place ourselves, as Moses is exhorting the Israelites to do, under the rule of God, or we can go our own way. Precisely the same issues are at stake for us as were at stake for Israel. God sets before us a blessing and a curse. And one way or another, every one of us must choose in this matter. And out of the aggregation of those personal choices, our nation must choose. There's no opting out of our responsibility. There's no permanent position of neutrality we can adopt, no fence on which we can sit. There are only two alternatives, the blessing or the curse, says Moses. One or other, we shall have. It makes sense then, doesn't it? When you look at it like that, to listen to Moses' advice on the question. Because in a very real sense, the exhortation he's offering to Israel in these verses, he's also offering to us. Let me list then for you these four incentives to obedience that I can identify in this long passage that we've read. We'll look at each in turn, and then we'll try and see how each applies, first to Israel and to us. Here are the four, then. First, reverence for the person of God. Second, understanding of the character of God. Third, gratitude for the grace of God. And fourth, desire for the reward of God. I think you'll quickly see how those four incentives each come out of these two chapters. We'll begin with the first, reverence for the person of God. Look back to the very first verse we read, chapter 10, verse 12. Now, O Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you but to fear the Lord your God? Now, we usually regard fear as an undesirable, negative feeling, don't we? A sign of cowardice, even in extreme. I think if you think about it, there are times when it's a necessary and an appropriate emotional response, isn't it? After all, the world is a dangerous place. And at its simplest, fear is simply an emotional defense mechanism built into us that recognizes how dangerous it is. The child who possesses no healthy respect for speeding vehicles may well be placed in peril by that fearlessness. The postman who saunters casually up the garden path to deliver the mail, careless of the large dog barking in the garden, may well find that when the dog decides to bite, his reactions are considerably less nimble than his more nervous colleague, who had enough adrenaline in his bloodstream as a result of his fear to make him move quick. Well, no doubt, excessive fear can demoralize us, can overwhelm us with feelings of inadequacy so that we're rendered incapable of handling situations. But a complete absence of fear is surely just as reprehensible. There's nothing virtuous about it. The reckless daredevil who boasts he's not afraid of anything, he's just a bighead, isn't he? And his arrogance will almost certainly lead him to self-destruction sooner or later. Now, when it's displayed in appropriate contexts and to a proportionate degree, fear is not to be equated with cowardice. It's very close to being a necessary component of humility. For to fear is to admit to ourselves our vulnerability, our insecurity. To fear is to acknowledge that we human beings are neither omnipotent nor immortal. It's to recognize that there are things in this universe bigger and more powerful than we are which dwarf and threaten us. Indeed, Moses is telling us here in Deuteronomy 10 that at its very best and noblest, to fear is to recognize that there is someone beyond the universe altogether who is bigger and more powerful than anything we can even imagine. Do you see how he describes him in verse 17? For the Lord your God is God of gods, Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. Surely you can feel the emotional response Moses is trying to generate by that rhetorical use of superlatives there. This God he's talking about is no puppet we can manipulate by our religious rituals. He's no abstraction we can theorize about in our philosophical debates. This God he's talking about is the supreme sovereign who cannot be overruled. He's the invincible warrior who cannot be defeated. He's the righteous judge who cannot be corrupted. In a word, he is the great God, the God who must be worshipped. When you Israelites take the name of this Lord on your lips, why, it ought to awaken in you a wonder, a dread, a reverence. What does the Lord your God ask of you but to fear the Lord your God? This is the first reason for choosing the path of obedience to God. Simple reverence for the mighty, majestic person he is. And that argument is no less relevant to us, you know, than it was to Israel. Do you know anything of that fear? Have you ever stood at the foot of a great waterfall? I did once in Africa. We haven't got waterfalls like that in England, unfortunately. hold you spellbound, you know, the gigantic power of that rushing water so close to hand. Maybe you've gone out on a cloudless night and felt yourself shrink to nothingness at the vast magnitude of the universe that you can see around you. Or maybe you've gone into a dark and empty house and suddenly shuddered with that uncanny suspicion that you're not alone. Some invisible, maybe even ghostly presence is there with you. Or maybe you've just sat in a corridor waiting to see somebody very, very important. And your knees have trembled and the cold sweat has broken out on your brow as you wondered how you could possibly stop yourself stammering when you spoke to them. Take those kinds of experiences and multiply them by 1,000 and extrapolate them to infinity. Maybe then you'll get a bit close to comprehending what it means to fear God. If we dare to ask why such a God should be obeyed, then we're merely proving we have never had such an experience. Reverence for his person, then. That's the first exhortation, the first incentive, the first reason Moses gives to choose the path of obedience and blessing. The second, understanding God's character. Look again back to that very first verse. What does the Lord your God ask of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in his ways? Now, by that word walk, I think Moses is placing his finger not so much upon the fine detail of God's moral law as upon the great general principles that inform God's law. Principles which, as Moses so clearly implies in that phrase, find their root within the character of God himself. It's his ways that we are to walk in. God calls us then not like a tyrant simply to do as we are told, but as a shepherd, to follow in his own steps. It's very important to understand that. Some people think of the Ten Commandments as though they were some kind of arbitrary test, dreamed up by God in much the same way that a teacher invents problems for a maths exam. What shall we give these Israelites to do? Well, thou shalt not steal. That's a good one. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Oh, they'll find that a tough nut to crack, all right. It's not like that at all, you see. The whole point of God's law is that it is the translation into the imperative of God's own moral nature. He says, do not lie, because he's truth. He says, do not hate, because he's love. He says, don't commit adultery, because he is faithfulness. These values matter to him because of the kind of moral character he has. And do you see how Moses spells this out very clearly in a particular example in verses 17 and 18? The Lord your God is a God of gods, a Lord of lords. He shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow and loves the alien, giving him food and clothing. So you are to love those who are aliens. For you yourselves were aliens in Egypt. See the implication of those verses. In their treatment of the weak and disadvantaged, Israel was to emulate the character of God. It was no arbitrary command he was giving when he said, care for the orphans and the widows. It was his own heart that he was expressing. He is concerned about orphans and widows. He is generous to the non-Israelite immigrant. Well, you are to walk in his ways and do the same. Your courts, your laws, your very attitudes to such vulnerable groups in the community, he's saying, are to be a conscious attempt to conform to the divine model which he provides. It ought to be particularly easy, says Moses, in regard to immigrants. For you were immigrants once yourself. You know what it feels like to be a stranger surrounded by a culture which you don't really share, a society you don't really belong to. You know firsthand how kind God was to you when he found you in that socially alienated environment. Well then, now the boot is going to be on the other foot. Make sure you copy God's ways, not those of your former Egyptian slave masters. You love the alien. You give him food and clothing. It's a powerful word, isn't it, to us in this multiracial society in which we live in today. But it isn't the specific issue of the treatment of foreigners that I want you to concentrate on, but the general principle which Moses is illustrating by that example. Maybe the best commentary of it at all is the words of St. Paul in the New Testament. Be imitators of God, he said. Believe that? Be imitators of God. Sounds presumptuous, but it isn't. For you see, the Bible says we human beings were made in the image of God. That's why no scientific analogy to machines or apes can possibly do justice to us. We can choose because God can choose. He's invested in us the same moral freedom he himself enjoys. And for that reason, human beings can only be fully understood and fully described by analogy, not to machines or animals, but to God himself. We are made in the image of God. Tragedy of the human race, of course, according to the Bible, is that we abused that God-like freedom. We chose contrary to God's moral character, and thus we marred and disfigured the divine image. But it is God's great ambition for us, and this is what the Bible is all about from cover to cover, it is God's great ambition for us, that that original divine likeness shall be restored. That's what God is looking for. A renewal of our character. A character which, like his own, does not defend the cause of the fatherless and the widow because it has some external rule that says you must alone, but which has justice as part of the very person. A character which, like his own, loves the alien because compassion is built into the very fabric of our being. That's what God is after. The restoration of the moral image of himself. Every now and again, of course, you meet someone who makes out that biblical standards of morality are somehow cramping and unnatural, don't you? How can we possibly discover real self-fulfillment as human beings, they say, with all those rules? See, nothing could be further from the truth. Obedience to God's standards is the most humanizing of activities. Because in a very real sense, it represents the rediscovery of our true selves. To choose the path of obedience is to walk in his ways. And there is no nobler vocation for any human being than that. That's the second reason, then, that Moses gives us, implicit here, for choosing the path of obedience. It is for our good, he says. It's what we're made for. Understanding God's character and our own. The third reason he gives is gratitude for God's grace. Look again at verses 14 and 15. To the Lord your God belong the heavens, even the highest heavens, the earth and everything in it. Yet the Lord set his affection on your forefathers and loved them, and he chose you their descendants above all the nations as it is today. Circumcise your hearts, therefore, and do not be stiff-necked any longer. As you scan your eyes through these verses we've read, I'm sure you will have noticed that again and again Moses is reminding the Israelites that their history has from cover to cover been a history of God's grace toward them. His grace in electing them, for a start. He chose you, he says there in verse 15, Before you even existed, he made a covenant promise to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, your forefathers. It was, says Moses, a quite incredibly generous thing to do. Do you notice that word yet at the beginning of verse 15? It's a very sharp disjunctive, that, in the Hebrew text. Here is a God, he says, who owns the entire universe. To the Lord your God belong the heavens, even the highest heavens, the earth, and everything in it. Yet, who does this God choose to love, who owns the entire universe? An insignificant little Middle Eastern tribe. Your forefathers. I, too, I use John Newton's phrase, it was an example of amazing grace. And it didn't stop there. For there was grace also showed in the way he multiplied them. You see in verse 22? Your forefathers who went down into Egypt were 70 in all, and now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars in the sky. The promise he'd made to Abraham, of course, had been cast in just those words. See if you can count the stars, Abraham. So shall your descendants be. Well, against all the odds, it had come true. In spite of Pharaoh's persecutions and the austerities of the wilderness, they were now a great company, numbered in thousands rather than dozens. Who'd done it? He had done it. The Lord God had done it in his grace to them. But supremely, of course, there was his grace in saving them. And Moses really goes to town, doesn't he, describing that at the beginning of chapter 11. Remember today that your children were not the ones who saw and experienced the discipline of the Lord your God, his majesty, his mighty hand, his outstretched arm, the signs he performed and the things he did in the heart of Egypt to Pharaoh and his whole country, what he did to the Egyptian army, how he overwhelmed them in the waters of the Red Sea as they were pursuing you. It wasn't your children who saw all these things, but you. By any standards, the deliverance from Egypt had been an utterly remarkable event. Perhaps for this second generation of Israelites, who'd been born in the wilderness, the story of the Exodus was already taking on the characteristics of a children's fairy tale. That may explain why Moses says, it wasn't your children who saw these things. Moses is impressing upon them the literal, eyewitness, historical nature of the whole affair and their personal involvement in it. It isn't just a good patriotic yarn to excite infantile imaginations like St. George and the Dragon. This, he says, it happened. You know it happened. The miraculous plagues, the miraculous crossing of the Red Sea, the miraculous incidents of your wilderness experience. Throughout the entire period of this history of theirs, God had been supernaturally intervening in their affairs to bring them out of slavery and into the enjoyment of his promises. And you know, says Moses, perfectly well how little you deserve all this favor. For from the beginning you've been refractory and uncooperative. As we were seeing last week, the whole 40 years of their wilderness wandering was marked by constant grumbling and rebellion. Subtly, Moses reminds them of that once again here in verses 6 and following, when he mentions Dathan and Abiram. These two attempted to plot a coup against Moses in the middle of the desert, and God rebuked them, swallowing up the conspirators in an earthquake. Well, now, says Moses, God is calling you to answer all this grace he has shown you. You've been rebellious and awkward time and time again. Now the time has come for it to stop. He calls you to answer his grace with gratitude. 10:16. Circumcise your hearts, therefore. And do not be stiff-necked any longer. Circumcision was, of course, the outward mark of Israel's special covenant relationship with God. But using this strange phrase, circumcise your hearts, God makes clear that he isn't satisfied with such external ceremonials. He wanted faithful hearts. All too often in those years since their departure from Egypt, there hadn't been faithful hearts. Well, the time has come when you must now choose, he says. Is that stiff-necked obstinacy going to continue? Or are you at last going to show God the same degree of covenant faithfulness he's displayed toward you? Love him, he says. Serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. That's what he wants. He deserves it. He's been so good to you. That's Moses' third argument for choosing the path of obedience. You may feel it's the most compelling of all, gratitude for grace. And I would suggest to you that it's every bit as relevant to you and me as it was to the Israelites, in fact, more so. For a start, it's relevant to us as a nation. As we've said repeatedly in earlier studies, Great Britain is not a chosen people in the same way Israel was, and we must beware of naive comparisons. Yet it has to be said that in many ways we as a society have experienced many similar blessings during our history to the blessings Israel had experienced. We too have been prospered from tiny beginnings. We too have known remarkable deliverances from tyranny. We spoke of some of them last week. To what are we going to attribute our national good fortune? To our parliamentary democracy? To our armed forces? If we're wise, we will, like Israel, recognize that all these things are the evidence of God's grace to us. An unworthy people. A people who don't deserve the least of his blessings. And that being so, surely we owe him a debt of gratitude, just as they did. There's no nation on earth which has greater cause to be thankful to God than ours. So would not Moses then say to us, as he said to the Israelites, circumcise your hearts, therefore. But beyond any amount of gratitude we may have as a particular nation, we have even more cause for gratitude than the Israelites today because of what God has done for us in his grace through Christ. Let me remind you of those words of the Apostle Paul again. You know the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ. Though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich. Whatever we owe God for his generosity to us as the British people, it's nothing to what we owe him for his generosity to us in Jesus. The covenant which he's made in his blood embraces not just the Jews, but the whole world. The salvation that was obtained through his cross delivers us not just from the political bondage of Egypt, but from the spiritual and moral bondage of our sin and guilt. The promised land, which he, by his resurrection from the dead, guarantees us, is no piece of territory in the Middle East. It is heaven itself. Doesn't that make you feel grateful? Mustn't anybody who really believes that that is what Jesus has done for us respond in obedience? Gratitude for grace. That's the third, I think, unanswerable incentive that Moses gives. But there is a fourth. And in a sense, we prepared the way for it by talking about the promised land and heaven. His fourth encouragement is a desire for the reward of God. And it brings us right back to the verse we began with, chapter 11, verse 26. See, I am setting before you today a blessing and a curse. Moses is convinced that you cannot possibly be the loser for choosing the path of obedience. On the contrary, only by choosing that path could Israel discover the blessing that God was willing to give to her. Time and again throughout this passage, he outlines what that blessing contained. There was the promised land, for a start, in verse 8. Observe, therefore, all the commands I'm giving you today, so that you may have the strength to go in and take over the land that you're crossing the Jordan to possess, and so that you may live long in the land the Lord swore to your forefathers. Marvelous as the land of milk and honey was, you see, they could inherit it only if God gave them the necessary strength of purpose. And he would only give them that on condition of their obedience. There was the blessing, too, of future prosperity. Verse 13, if you faithfully obey the commands I'm giving you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will send rain on your land in its season, both autumn and spring rains, so that you may gather in your grain, new wine and oil. I'll provide grass in the fields for your cattle. You will eat and be satisfied. The point of this is, you see, that Palestine was an altogether more fertile place than the wilderness, or even than Egypt. For Egypt depended for its fertility upon constant irrigation. It was hard work growing things in Egypt. But in Palestine, there was a natural fertility. The only caution about it was that it depended totally on God's annual gift of rain. And says Moses, that gift, that blessing, depends on obedience. And thirdly, there was the blessing of peace and security. Verse 22, if you carefully, notice that if again and again, if you carefully observe all these commands I'm giving you to follow, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways and to hold fast to him, then the Lord God will drive out all these nations before you, and you will dispossess nations larger and stronger than you. No man will be able to stand against you. As Israel stood on the bank of Jordan, she knew the territory she was about to invade was already occupied by peoples who were much stronger, both numerically and in terms of military technology, than she was. And it was only God who could win the battles upon which their long-term survival in the land depended. And that, says Moses yet again, was contingent, was conditional on obedience. God had been generous to Israel in all kinds of ways in the past, blessing them without requiring anything in return at all. But now he was calling in the debt. You've had a taste of what I can do for you, he said. But now if you want the full meal, if you want the blessing, you must choose right. See, I'm setting before you today a blessing and a curse. He said it to Israel. I suggest to you he's saying it to us also. He's saying to us this morning, if we want the blessing of God, we must choose correctly. We must choose the path of obedience. Reverence for his person demands we obey him. Understanding his character demands we obey him. Gratitude for his grace demands we obey him. But if all these things fail to persuade us, says Moses, surely simple self-interest would persuade you to obey him too. It is the path of blessing which is the path of obedience. Do you want his reward or not? I believe that choice confronts us as a nation right now. Some of you may know, or have seen in the papers yesterday, I think, the report of a speech by the Home Secretary, Douglas Hurd, in Tamworth, on the 200th anniversary of the birth of Robert Peel in that town. In that speech, the Home Secretary warns of what he calls a serious heart disease in Britain. The fabric of society has disintegrated to a dangerous degree, he complained. Unless there is an upturn in self-discipline and public morality, the benefits, which he claims are now emerging from the growth in our economy, could be lost. It's quite a hard-hitting speech. He criticizes the failure of parents, the failure of school teachers, and the failure of the churches to promote moral responsibility among our people. And I have to say, I welcome his observations. I could have wished that he would have been a little more honest about the culpability of the government in this moral landslide. He doesn't seem to mention them at all. It was, after all, Mr. Hurd himself who wanted to put the demands of a market economy above both the family and the church when he supported Sunday trading not so long ago. And if Mrs. Thatcher doesn't approve of wishy-washy liberalism among her senior churchmen, she's only herself to blame. She appoints the archbishops, after all. As for blaming the teachers, well, one looks in vain for any sign that moral education is going to be placed very high on the agenda of Mr. Baker's new education bill. That particular legislation seems to be more designed to produce computer programmers than responsible citizens. But in spite of its inevitable hypocrisy, I suppose, at least Mr. Hurd's speech has given a signal to the nation that he recognises things are going wrong. The escalating crime statistics are only the tip of the iceberg of a social degeneration that goes far beyond what can be explained naively by youth unemployment or inner-city dereliction. It is a moral decay at the heart of our people today. And as we have said repeatedly in these past few times that we've studied Deuteronomy together, it is closely associated with the fact that we have abandoned our identity as a nation under God. And that being so, I know only one way it can be arrested. "See," says Moses, "I am setting before you today a blessing and a curse. You and I can decide today to offer our lives to God, to fear Him, to walk in His ways, to love Him, to serve Him with heart and soul, and to observe His commands. We can choose to do that. He deserves it. It's what we were created for. We owe it to Him as a debt of gratitude for all His grace to us, and in any case, it's in our own interests. For there is a heaven to be gained and a hell to be shunned. And there is no neutral middle ground between the two. God sets before us a blessing and a curse. Do we want His reward or not?" He asks us. The choice is ours. And upon that choice hinges the destiny of our nation and of our souls.